this time tomorrow.
Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. This is the second part of our programme with Ray Davis.
Sailing across an empty sea.
Hello and welcome to Master Tapes, and Ray Davis playing the Kinks classic This Time Tomorrow for our audience here at Maida Vale Studios. In the first part of this edition, I talked to Ray about the making of two linked albums from the heyday of Ray's band, the Kinks, Lola vs. Power Man and The Money Go Round Part 1, and then the album Muswell Hillbillies.
Well, I'm not the world's most physical guy, but don't you squeeze me tight, you nearly broke my spine. Man, but I don't wanna be him. You've come a long way from the runny-nosed and scruffy kid I knew. This time tomorrow, where will we be?
We heard about the concepts that lay behind the two albums, about the very English lyrical themes and the very American musical influences. This is what we like to think of as the B-side of the programme. Now it's the turn of our studio audience to ask the questions, possibly about Lola and Muswell Hillbillies, but also about their legacy and Ray's career since. And we'll have some more live music. But our first question comes from Mark Johnson, who's an engineer and songwriter.
I attended your songwriting course held in Devon in September 2011. During the course, you asked us to compose songs to accompany films. Were there any specific films that influenced you in the writing of the songs for the Lola album or Muswell Hillbillies? And more generally, how does the influence of film reflect in your songwriting?
Two questions. I'll answer the second part first. Growing up in post-war England, with film-mad sisters like I had. I was about five, and my sisters were also much older, in their teens, and one was 20. So that I used to have the guy as a chaperone, and I saw The Crimson Pirate with Burt Lancaster five times in 1 week. So I grew up with epic melodies. It springs to mind some of those great Hollywood writers, Bernard Herrmann, who wrote Psycho, and Miklos Rosa, who wrote epic movies. He wrote the music to Ben-Hur. They epic chord moments, like power chords. But going back to the first part, on Lola vs. Power Man, there's a song called The Contender. And again, I'm with my brother. We had a smirk in the studio, the famous speech from On the Waterfront, where Marlon Brando's being sort of conned by his brother. That says a lot about Dave and I, my brother. And he said, "I could have had a shot at the title, but you managed me badly. You know, I could have been a contender." And wordplay like that, probably wouldn't have heard that word that often, contenders. It wasn't in our vocabulary. Because I studied painting, composition enters my world. I visualise songs quite often before I write them. Waterloo Sunset is very painterly as an image. So images come into my head a lot.
Did you imagine the characters of Terry and Julie? Did you know what they looked like?
Sorry, I've just stuck chewing gum in my ear as an earplug. So, I've got my devices so mixed up. What was the question? Sorry.
With that song, with Waterloo Sunset, did you imagine the characters of Terry and Julie? You know, can you see what they look like in your head when you're writing that song?
No, they're faceless people. I wrote it for a generation. Again, I keep going back to my sisters. Their generation, who lived through the Second World War. A lot of people died in the war. It's a terrible event. But a lot of people survived it and had great memories of it. And it amazed me as a child to hear all these stories. But I wrote it about their generation finding their utopia somewhere at the other side. It doesn't matter whether it's north. I sense that the river is going from south to north. But that's the only sort of visualization I have of it. I didn't cast it, sadly, as Terence Stamp, Julie Christie.
Because that's what everybody imagines, isn't it?
If it had been a Hollywood movie, it would have been.
Okay.
But faceless people.
Right.
And they're good enough to write for, because I've written for a lot of faceless people, and they deserve to be written about.
And let me just throw the question back to Mark Johnson, who asked the question initially. When you were at this writing course that Ray was overseeing, did you come away as a songwriter with traces of Ray Davies in your songs that you've written since, do you think?
Yes, definitely. Three songs that I wrote during that week have materialised on my latest record.
Right.
So this is the promotion opportunity.
Yes, thank you very much.
Next question. This one's from Belinda Latchford.
The Money Go Round is a trenchant indictment of the way inexperienced musicians and songwriters were exploited by the industry when you started up. Do you think much has changed since then?
I think writers have got better deals, recording artists have better deals. The bottom line is still the same. I think having retained my career, fortunately, of putting records out all this time, I'm still putting them out, the amount of pressure on new artists to deliver is immense now. The deals have got better, but the margins have got tighter, and the crooks are still there. But careers are not designed to have longevity anymore, it seems to me. See some of these poor kids, X Factor kids, going out there. They'll be on TV for like a year or two if they're lucky, and then they'll vanish. That's the great thing about being in a band. I think if I'd been a solo artist, I would have got out of the business. Something about our band, it says a lot about the people within the Kinks. We're a team. United, we were indestructible. Even when we were climbing back in America, people hated us being the support act because we'd just blow them off the stage.
What I'm interested in is what you just said there about whether you would have continued if you're a solo artist. You needed the band around you because you were a gang. I mean, you have to survive as a gang.
It's true, but we're notorious for having infighting and fights. It was awful being in the Kinks in many respects. But when we got on the stage, we said it's them or us, and it was us against the world, which kept us going.
And around this time also, you moved from Pye, your British record label, to the American RCA label. And here's a question which actually comes via Twitter from Paul Whitelaw. He tweeted us, "I love the Lola album, but it feels like half a concept LP. Was Ray's original intention to make it all about the music industry?" Well, in the first part of this programme, we heard how the album was conceived in two parts, because this is Lola, Power Man, Money Go Round Part 1. But not all of the songs are addressing the music industry, are they?
No. First part is the hero confronts the beast and wins. His follow-up is the hero becomes the beast. So that's what the through line would have been.
Yeah, but you're not thinking of resurrecting it from the archive. Those songs must still survive.
There's some songs exist, yeah, sketches. But I wasn't keeping many notes at that time.
So any demos?
Yeah, there's a couple.
A couple
in the archives.
But otherwise you've got the concept and fragments of the
fragment
in your head. It's
yeah,
all there.
Yeah, but it's just a technical issue. Does the record company own everything or only what was released? It's a legal argument I'm about to embark on.
Oh, really? So you are actually challenging this legally?
Yeah, of course. You've got to do that.
Well, they don't own what was never made, though, surely.
Do you really want to have a talk about this?
Well,
because this is not an appropriate conference. Where's this, 11 o'clock at night? It's late at night, so we... Well, no, I have a theory of those all-in deals. The corporations, they want to own everything, but they don't own ideas, and that's what my fight is about. That's why I'll keep making records and maybe revisit part two.
Very good. Well, the Kinks fans will be waiting with bated breath for that one. Let's go with another question from our studio audience here at Maida Vale. This is from Sam Weeway, who is a sales executive.
A Long Way From Home from Lola vs. Power Man seems to me a beautiful and poignant plea to your younger brother. But what makes it so stirring is Dave's harmonies. What drove you to write the song, and how did Dave feel about its content?
Long Way From Home. Did I sing the lead? I think I did. He comes in as harmony. Sorry, it's been a long time. It's the lack of training that makes it work. A normal musical line would have ended a different way by a trained singer. Because he sings from his soul, it ends appropriately for him, but it's probably totally the wrong harmonic note to resolve on. But I always write with that machine. His voice is a machine, and you stretch it, and you work with it. I had nobody else. He sings like a flamenco singer sometimes at the top of his range. He's got that wonderful vibrato, I use that a lot, yeah.
And Sam was suggesting that that song, Long Way From Home, is about your brother, Dave, or you were addressing him in that song.
It's a warning. Remember, Dave was 16 when we had our first number one, and I was a few years older, 3 years older. So it's a warning for someone who has fame and everything you want so quickly overnight and so young, not to lose touch of where you're from. Never forget where you're from.
And the perennial question is whether you're going to be working with Dave again, whether the Kinks can reform. I know the answer previously has been your eyes start to glaze over, you shake your head.
No.
Are you any closer to any kind of musical collaboration with your brother?
It's like Rocky Graziano coming out for one more round with Sugar Ray Robinson. You've gone 14 rounds, you've got to come out for the 15th. You glaze over when you're that prospect. But if it's one more round, I still might be able to win. So if I
yeah. You don't know when the bell's going to ring then?
Well, it's still that long minute.
That's such a... you've just... well...
Yeah. I always, with Dave, made the engineer have the record button on because I'd probably say something to make him angry and he'd play something stunning.
So you could antagonise him musically and you would get a better performance.
Just state my point of view.
Right, next question. This is from Olga Ryoko, who describes herself as a songwriter and actress.
The Kinks were constantly evolving, each transition bringing its own wonderful songs. On looking back over nearly 50 years, do you have a favourite period?
The best time was doing two sell-out nights at Madison Square Garden after being banned for 4 years and fighting our way back. Not necessarily the greatest songs I've written, but finding a market in America again. It was no mean feat to do that, because you don't come back, generally speaking.
What about a moment in the studio or a period of time in making albums? Is there a golden
moment? Yeah, the golden moment was when I turned to my brother and said, this producer doesn't know what he's doing. So I started producing myself.
Right.
No disrespect to our first producer. But when songs get so personal and you can't convey those ideas, that wall, that glass between the engineer, producers and the artists, when it turns into a brick wall with no communication, if you can't reach out to that person, there's no point in having a relationship. When I realised I could take over myself, that was a shining moment. And also the biggest moment as a writer was seeing my name on the disc. I wrote that song. I didn't realise it would be printed. It was amazing. I wasn't getting paid for it, but it's small memories like that.
But you knew early on you needed creative control, total artistic control, not only as a songwriter, lyricist, but also producer.
Yeah, even with You Really Got Me. I'm not a musician. People say you're a musician. I'm a writer, a creative spirit, more than anything else. And You Really Got Me had to be recorded a certain way because I thought I'd never write another song after that. It's about the fifth song I ever wrote. So I didn't know I was going to do this. It's a steady job up until now.
Next question's from Robert Stiles, who describes himself as a music-loving dad of three.
If you were to record 20th Century Man for the first time today, do you agree that the only thing you'd need to change to reflect the current landscape would be the title?
I think I'd change the drummer. There is a scary answer to that. There was a man called the Unibomber, Ted Kaczynski, who was responsible for horrible atrocities, and they found a manifesto in his cabin where he lived. Somebody said it was identical to the lyrics of 20th Century Man, which is a bit scary. I've been playing it on tour in the UK recently, and it's devastatingly in touch with the way I feel about the world.
And this is the first song on the Muswell Hillbillies album. We talked about it in the first part of this programme, and how it sets the tone on that album for something that's darker and angrier, possibly, than the stuff that you've done before.
The subplot, we talked earlier about the artwork being a street that's being demolished. The 20th Century Man, in my view, I write a subplot to everything I write. He's got the last house and he's put dynamite to himself. And he says, so they come near my house, I'm going to blow myself up. So that's the attitude I went into writing that song with. La-li-la-di-da. But it resonates with a modern audience.
Robert, you still think that's a song which is as relevant as when it was written then, do you?
Certainly. I listened to it today and I think, crikey, if you'd heard this for the first time today, you'd think it was written about today.
Yeah, I found that performing it.
Do you ever go back to lyrics and think, well, actually, it doesn't fit in the 21st century, do you ever tweak lyrics to make them relevant to today or to give them new meaning?
Oh, when I'm performing live?
Yeah.
No, you want to recapture the moment. It's like saying to Noel Coward, you know, rewrite Mad Dogs and Englishmen. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear him do it in his dated voice.
And that song, 20th Century Man, on the Muswell Hillbillies album, the protagonist railing against the modern world. And here we are now in a new century, in the 21st century. And we've had a couple of questions come through via email and Twitter. You don't tweet, do you?
I don't have the time.
And do you download records or do you still buy vinyl?
I always made my brother buy the records. I save my pocket money.
Another question from the audience. This is from Robbie Boyd.
Do you ever get anxious about writing a new song and fear that it won't be as good as the last one? How do you shake off that anxiety?
You're talking about anxiety in connection with songwriting or in general? I did a film once for TV called Return to Waterloo, and it was about a man who was obsessed with this blonde woman. And the interviewer was from one of these then broadsheets, said, "Do women frighten you?" I just said, "I'm frightened of everything." I think anxiety is good. Use it. One of the first books I ever bought after I started writing songs was called An Actor Prepares by Stanislavski. He was a drama coach.
The method man.
Method acting. Hmm. And some of the rules you apply to acting can apply to songwriting. Using the situation you're in. You know, I made a few films. And my producer, Dennis Wolfe, had come from the documentary sector. I was trying to make features. I said, "I can't get the shot, there's no light." He said, and he'd say, answer that. He'd say, "Use what you've got. And if anxiety comes into your framework, use it. Feel grateful that you recognise it."
Embrace your anxiety then. Embrace all of your
anything,
feelings.
Anything that inspires is
and
good.
Has the songwriting process changed? I mean, thinking back to these songs that you wrote 40 years ago and we've been asking you to kind of get yourself back into that mindset, and you think about the way that you write now, is it very much in the same way?
I think as one matures, when you're younger, you're more instinctively editorial. I'm still wanting to rewrite Waterloo Sunset. It's out now and I can't change it.
What would you change about that song?
Some of the grammar, but it wouldn't be as interesting. I was recording it with Jackson Browne on this collaborations album I did a year or two ago. And he read the words out and he said, "And I don't need no friends." Where's that from? It's like when you speak something.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds different to the way you sing it. And sometimes that's what intrigues a listener to getting things wrong. Again, going back to the anxiety thing, don't be afraid to get things wrong. I've got this saying, feel free to fail. It's quite hard. You can always say that with the Kinks, concept albums, whatever. We always try to push the envelope and stretch the boundaries. And we failed a lot. No band around as long as the Kinks have failed so often. And that's a tribute.
And you're still writing? I mean, you're still writing how often? Every day? Do you have to get things out of your system?
When I get all my tweeting and my emails out of the way, there's not much time left in the day.
Is there a song in your head at the moment?
Yeah.
A new one?
Yeah.
What would it sound like?
What would it sound like?
Yeah, just give us a sense of the song that's going round and round in your head at the moment that might be the next Ray Davies song.
Show Me the Door So I Can Get Out of Here.
Sounds like a great title, actually.
I came up with a good one. I can't tell you because somebody else would do it. It's a great title.
You're not going to tell us?
No.
Well, no, in effect, you've copyrighted it.
Can I say something? When I first went to Denmark Street, and I was first being signed, and everybody heard about the Kinks, this new talent, I walked in to two heroes of mine, Lieber and Stoller, and I think it was Mike Stoller played the piano. As soon as they knew there was another writer in the room, they shut the piano and put the music away.
You are proprietorial about your work then, are you?
Yeah.
So you're not even going to whistle
such
the next
a great
tune.
Title.
No.
It won't make sense without the rest of it, and the rest of it's not formulated. Some songs, the title is in the punchline, and it's like having a punchline with no joke in front of it.
Right. Let's move on. Next question's from Chris Jones, who's retired.
Do you think that Noah and the Whales' recent track, Life Goes On, was heavily influenced by Lola? And did you notice the likeness?
I know Noah and the Whale, but I must have been away because I haven't heard the track.
Have you been told about it?
Yeah, people have mentioned it, but, you know, I'm still waiting for 1980 to happen. I'm sure they're influenced by it, and there's a similar sensibility, probably.
Might be a bit more than that. I mean, put it this way, if it's not homage, then it's an amazing coincidence.
Mm. Well, I'll eat cheese with anything.
What does that mean?
Wordplay, dear boy.
All right.
But I will listen to it, and if need be, I will take appropriate action.
A very successful singer-songwriter once told me that to get by in the music business, you need two things: great songs and a very good lawyer.
Well, I've had some good songs and some bad lawyers. So.
Another question. This is from Jamie Cummings, who works for a skate company.
Of all the artists who have covered your songs in the past, do you have a particular favourite?
Yeah, Jonah and the Whale has done a great job.
Noah and the Whale, even.
I had a business manager in America. He was old school. And he said, Ray, I'm doing so good. I just signed a new act. They're the biggest thing. They're big friends of mine. They're called New Kids Around the Block. No, I think I always liked the Pretenders' Stop Your Sobbing because they added an instrumental section. You can easily cover a hit and turn it into something because it's been a hit already. But I really envy and admire people that have taken my songs that haven't obviously been popular and taken them and made them good records.
Pretenders did a couple of your songs, in fact, didn't they? Because they did I Go to Sleep as well.
Yeah. Now, that song was written, commissioned by Peggy Lee. She was one of my older sister's favourite singers. And I got to write a song for her. It wasn't a major hit, but the producer actually asked me how I wanted it to be recorded. It was just such an honour. You know, I was 19.
I never knew that. You wrote that for Peggy Lee. Were you there when she recorded it?
No. There was a singer called Mary Wells came in and heard my demo. I was in New York. She said, I want that song. I said, you can't have it.
But did you write it with Peggy Lee in mind? Because to me, it sounds like, on the original Kinks version, it sounds like an archetypal Ray Davies song, that one.
Yeah. I'm not asked very often to write for other people, but I'd love to be given the opportunity because there's something in casting songs for people. It's a real art form. And I did have her voice in mind when I wrote it.
Mm.
If you listen to the what they call the bridge, the middle, I can't remember the chords, E minor, and it goes to probably a... I go to sleep, bing, bing, sleep, ba, ba, imagine it, and the bridge goes where I was wrong, I was wrong, I would love it till the day I die. Okay?
Yeah.
I love it. So if you listen to her sing, the lyrics themselves evoke to me her voice, her style. And I wrote the bridge for her.
Beautiful song. Mm. Here's another question about your vast songbook. This one's from Dawn Roderick.
Which one song from any of your albums best represents you?
That's a very hard question, man. Going back to what we've been talking about in this programme, This Time Tomorrow represents a lot about the way I am as a person. I see great importance in trivial things. If I were on a street and I had a little camera, I'd focus on a piece of newspaper on the floor blowing in down the gutter, and there'd be a war going on around me and I'd miss the big picture. My attention to detail is up for scrutiny. I pick non-attractive people to write about, but at the same time, I like to evoke big emotions. This Time Tomorrow is about, where's this guy going? I mean, he's got no sense of direction. He's just being allowed to be up there in the spaceship. There's a bit in the song, though, it says, I don't know where I'm going, I don't want to see. But that's quite like me.
Well, we've had some fabulous insight into your songwriting. That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. Thanks for your questions. Thanks to our audience here. Thanks to Bill Shanley and to James Walburn for accompanying Ray. But most of all, thanks to Ray Davies. You can tweet us using the hashtag BBC Mastertapes. Don't forget the Mastertapes pages on the Radio 4 website. It will have exclusive content, and you can download both parts of this edition as well as the other programmes in the series. And you'll get full versions of some of the songs that we've been talking about, including this one. We're leaving you tonight with Ray Davies playing Long Way From Home. And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Mastertape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Mastertapes pages via the Radio 4 website.
You've come a long way from home.
and a runny nose, scruffy kid I knew.